welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. Before we get into our specific topic today, I'd like to tell you about a recent opinion piece in the New York Times that has everything to do with the overarching focus of this radio program, which is the relational shift. I started this program last year so I could keep learning about the current phenomenon I'd been tracking and had presented a couple of years ago in my book, Relational Reality. That's where I gathered scores, maybe hundreds, of examples of recent discoveries, nearly all in the past 10 years, that the physical world, including human beings, is far, far more dynamically interrelated than modern systems of knowledge had ever guessed. And a lot of these discoveries were in human physiology, how our body really works in relationship to other people, in relationship to nature, in relationship to internal dynamic interrelationships, and also how we learn as humans. So I was fascinated by all this, and as I say, I wanted to keep exploring it. Because these new discoveries are now causing profound changes in nearly every field. They're rippling through the culture. And this is what I call the relational shift. So I saw this opinion piece by Nicholas Christakis, who's both unusually an MD and a sociologist. He's at Yale. And he wrote this piece saying, look, these big changes have already taken place within the biological sciences because of this new relational perspective. So how come the social sciences are so slow to get with the program and remake themselves according to the relational shift? Though he doesn't use that terminology. But he starts out by saying, the title of this is Let's Shake Up the Social Sciences. Starts out by saying, 25 years ago when I was a graduate student, there were departments of natural science that no longer exist today. Now, that's news to me because I thought the new programs were just being added alongside the old ones. But he says the old ones have been completely shoved off the table, or it would be more accurate to say blended in to the new relational perspective. Departments of anatomy, histology, biochemistry, and physiology have disappeared, replaced by innovative departments such as systems biology. And then he goes on later and saying, so isn't it time to create new social science departments that would reflect this complexity and interrelationship, this focus on how everything really is working according to dynamic interrelationship? And he said, shouldn't we have new programs like biosocial science or network science or neuroeconomics or behavioral genetics and things like that? So I just thought that was interesting. In case you think my hobby horse here is just a countercultural interest, it is really big and it's changing things the way we had hoped many decades ago would happen but didn't, and it's finally happening because of these new, very accessible discoveries in human physiology, biology, and other life sciences. Okay, now today we're going to focus on that most important dynamic relationship of all, the one that a whole lot of people cannot seem to wrap their minds around, the one that is a matter of life or death for hundreds of thousands of species on the planet, including ours. Yes, indeed, I'm referring to the crisis of global climate disruption. And before I introduce my guest today, I'd like to bring you an update about an aspect of this big issue, an aspect I've been wondering about for a long time. To wit, since the price of photovoltaics has come way down, and since we desperately need to lower the amount of our carbon dioxide emissions, why is it that we do not see solar energy panels on nearly every rooftop of homes, businesses, and public buildings across the country? Nearly all parts of our country get plenty of sun to pull this off, so what's stopping it from happening? So I brought this up when I was having a conversation on this program with Richard Heinberg last March, And we had both been at a conference where someone who works in the wind power energy had said, yes, it's quite possible to have completely renewable resources for energy, but actually the landscape would look pretty ugly and industrial. It would just consist of miles and miles of these wind turbines. And so I said to Richard Heinberg, why did he say that? I mean, why isn't the vision for the future rooftops, as far as we can see, with solar panels on them? And Richard Heinberg explained that one of the big problems is that the current national energy grid we have is built to be a one-way delivery system from the power plants to the large transformers and then to the houses. And if all the houses were producing their own energy and a little more than they need, and we're therefore sending back the extra energy to the utility company because they sell it back to them, they get paid for that excess energy. If that were to happen from a lot of sources, it would probably destabilize the grid. At least that's what's widely thought, because it's not designed for that. So that was kind of depressing news. But then I saw an article in the July-August issue of Sierra Magazine, which comes out of the national headquarters of Sierra Club. And this is all about the development of microgrids for small geographic areas, which would solve that problem Richard Heinberg was talking about. So I just want to tell you about the beginning of this article, which is called The Power of Microgrids. One obstacle to using cleaner, more local renewable power is the power grid itself. Our antiquated system of regional grids is, for the most part, hardwired to route electricity from big power plants. In fact, utilities have warned, as Richard Heinberg said, that the grid could go haywire if local decentralized power exceeds 15% of supply. Microgrids offer an intriguing path to semi-independence. A microgrid empowers a geographic area to use its own electricity when it's available and to rely on the existing utility grid when it's not. If the big grid flickers, the microgrid can hum along in island mode and keep critical functions running. As we enter an era of superstorms, that could mean fewer blackouts. And if these local energy sources are renewable, it means a smaller carbon footprint. A solar-powered microgrid operates on Alcatraz Island in San Francisco Bay, and some factories create mini power plants from their own steam. Other institutions, including the University of California at San Diego and about 40 U.S. military bases, are building their own grids. And then it tells how a community microgrid might work someday in your neighborhood. Okay, then I was feeling better. But last Sunday, the LA Times ran sort of an expose about another dynamic that's blocking the appearance of solar panels on all those rooftops. And it says, for years, power companies have watched warily as solar panels have sprouted across the nation's rooftops. Now, in almost panicked tones, the power companies are fighting hard to slow the spread. And as someone at the Electric Power Research Institute says, we did not get in front of this disruption, and it may be too late. Well, yeah, let's hope. But meanwhile, they're pulling out the stops over this battle in a couple of areas. And they're really leaning on state legislators and regulators to do a couple of things. One thing the utility companies' lobbyists want them, the lawmakers to do and the regulators to do, is reconsider, this is in Arizona, a generous residential credit, and impose new fees on customers who are going to use solar. And at the heart of the fight is a credit system called net metering, which pays residential and commercial customers for excess renewable energy they sell back to utilities. Currently, 43 states and the District of Columbia offer this incentive, and some set the credit with the wholesale price of a kilowatt of energy. But some say you should set the price at the daytime retail rate that you would be charging for this electricity. So there's that argument. And as I say, the argument of fees against people who have solar. And it does say the solar companies have now formed their own lobbying group, so that's good. But the gist of this is, this one spokesperson for a solar company says, the next 6 to 12 months are the watershed moment for distributed energy in this country. So I'm telling you this in case you're part of any group or you call in radio shows or anything. Pay attention to what your state is doing about its credit, tax credits for putting solar panels on houses and businesses, and whether the utility companies in your state are trying to get a fee imposed. Pay attention to all that, because there needs to be a big uproar against that and in favor of moving in the same direction. Ah, if only. So, today we're going to hear about the blocking of climate progress, as I've been talking about, but on another level. And it's the level of the attempted international agreements through the United Nations conferences on the climate crisis, which, as you all know, have been tragic lost opportunities. And we'll be hearing today about one of the major reasons for that. My guest today is Victor Minotti. He's the executive director of the International Forum on Globalization, a grand organization I've long known. It's headquartered in San Francisco. The International Forum on Globalization is a research, advocacy, and action organization founded in 1994, focused on the impacts of dominant economic and geopolitical policies, led by an international board of scholars and citizen movement leaders from 10 countries. IFG collaborates with environmental, social justice, and anti-militarism activists, seeking secure models of democracy and sustainability locally and globally. As their executive director, Victor Minotti has written and spoken extensively about globalization's impacts on ecosystems, and he has helped to build international networks among traditional farming, forest, fishing, and indigenous communities whose survival depends on them. He's the author of the following IFG reports. First one is Free Trade, Free Logging, How the World Trade Organization Undermines Global Forest Conservation. That was 1999. And then the WTO and Sustainable Fisheries. That was 2002. And then The Other Oil War, the Halliburton Agenda in WTO Energy Services, 2004. And he wrote the chapter on WTO and Native Sovereignty in the book entitled Paradigm Wars, Indigenous Peoples' Resistance to Economic Globalization. That is a great book. It came out in 2006, now in a new second edition. So Victor Minotti convened global civil service networks in 2008 to frame coordinated approaches to their efforts to establish new international institutions for finance, technology, and indigenous rights in the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. Since then, he's launched IFG's Plutonomy program to identify the individuals who are financing the opposition to the phase-out of fossil fuels. The International Forum on Globalization's most recent reports, Outing the Oligarchy, Billionaires Who Benefit from Today's Climate Crisis, and the one we'll talk about today, Faces Behind a Global Crisis, U.S. Carbon Billionaires and the U.N. Climate Deadlock. These call attention to the rising role of a few individuals who form the financial and ideological leadership of efforts to undermine urgent emission cuts. My guest today holds a degree in international relations from UCLA and speaks several languages. Victor Minotti, welcome to the program.
Hi, Charlene.
So I have read your IFG report, Faces Behind a Global Crisis, U.S. Carbon Billionaires and the U.N. Climate Deadlock, in which you lay out the many ways in which the Koch brothers block attempts to get a sane set of energy laws and policy in our country, which is truly hair-raising, all the things they do. But I'm still unclear about the link you propose in the title and in the report between their nefarious bending of our democracy in their direction and the fact that nothing much ever seems to happen on the international level with the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. So I get it that you do state clearly that the failure of the United States to have a rational energy policy in place undercuts the efforts at the UN climate conferences, but how does that work exactly? And I ask that because the world went ahead with the Kyoto Protocol without participation by the United States, even though that was not binding and fizzled out over time. But why would we, the United States, be the one deal breaker regarding an international treaty? And I have a related question, too. In addition to our showing up at those conferences, our representatives with our preposterously corrupt energy laws back home, is it that the Koch brothers' companies and others like them actively work on representatives from other countries at those conferences to derail any sort of serious agreement to cut carbon emissions? And I wonder that because they certainly did do that at the Kyoto Protocol conference, where scores of lobbyists from the energy transnational corporations poured off the planes, and many were assigned to each representative from a so-called developing country. And those lobbyists pumped up the representatives with indignation that the West, having already become rich and advanced, were now going to deny the so-called third world that same opportunity via a rush of fossil fuels. So obviously at that critical moment in history, one wishes dearly that there'd been an organized effort to get the developing countries to say, hey, you know, we're not going to sign this treaty unless we get a lot of free technology assistance for the installation of lots of solar and other renewable ways to generate electricity. We do want to increase our power base, but we don't want to do it in the polluting way you all did it. Well, alas, that counter campaign was never mounted at Kyoto. So anyway, here's my question. Please explain exactly what the connection is between the Koch brothers' domination of U.S. energy policy and laws and the UN-level efforts on climate change.
Well, the U.S. is the biggest polluter in the world.
Yeah.
We have for many years. China has recently been rising. But if you look at the historical emissions and sort of the history of negotiating this treaty, it's always been on the U.S., and the U.S. has agreed to lead, but it has yet to. And so, you know, other countries, China, India, Brazil, many of the emerging nations that whose, you know, consumption of fossil fuels is rising, also see the science and are taking actions. They're not waiting around for the U.S. to get its act together, but they're saying that if you guys do, that's going to, you know, increase the ambition and urgency of all the other countries because, you know, as our being the most responsible nation for so many emissions, they need to see the U.S. Come into a global deal.
See how they are working within Brazil and their own countries, as you say, and China doing a few things. But
well, China's doing much more than the U.S.
Saying,
and so much,
we're not going to sign on an international
countries.
Treaty unless the U.S. does.
Say again?
The fact that they know the science and are taking some ameliorative efforts inside their own country seems a different issue from the fact that they would sit at the table and say, we're not signing unless the U.S. signs.
Well, they need to know what it is they're signing, and they could all sign something. But what they really need is the most responsible for the crisis to step up as well and make the commitment.
Yeah, that would be good.
So that's why we've looked at what's really blocking the U.S. from getting a national climate policy and going to that U.N. table to really cut a deal and spur the scale of global cooperation that we need. And that's where we've, you know, done our homework and followed the money and come to focus on the Kochs, who are the world's two wealthiest men now.
The idea is we're so big, it really can't move forward until we get on board. Is that it?
Yeah, I mean, since World War II, that's the U.S. has been sort of the indispensable nation in so many multilateral talks with the WTO,
but there are also a lot of them
IMF,
never signed Law of the Sea and human rights, and they went on without us.
Well, the and where are they? You know, the Law of the Sea isn't so strongly enforced. The U.S. now may be interested in it because it may offer the U.S. a regime to carve up deep sea mining around the oceans.
Uh-huh.
With the human rights, the U.S. has not really championed U.N. enforcement of the human rights declarations and covenants, and that's a growing movement around the world. And the U.S. will probably continue to fight those things, as they would commitments to cut its emissions and take its responsibility in keeping, you know, avoiding a climate crisis. That's what the convention says. And we've formally said we'd do it, but we need to take the national action to do it.
Yeah. Okay, well, I have the advantage over the listeners since I've read this interesting booklet. Can you tell them something about what you discovered with the Koch's nefarious influence?
Well, I think the headline that people need to know is that they've outspent all the other oil companies, even Exxon, when it comes to opposing the phase-out of fossil fuels. We've looked at direct lobbying expenditures, at contributions to congressional candidates, to money to think tanks, and all sorts of different categories. That's what's laid out in the different chapters of the report. And in every category,
the charts are very clear. The way you make it, you know, the visuals are very good, I feel.
Oh, good. We look hard on those. I'm glad to hear that.
No, I mean, the whole thing was good about what they're doing to our country. I just missed the leap to the international level. But I think this is a hugely important issue. And here and elsewhere, where you said they even benefit from the sequester. They benefit from everything they push the Republicans to do. Then, less regulation. We don't have enough inspectors. I mean, it's really, once, you know, you have that chart, what is it, Coctopus with the long tentacles going out everywhere? It's just amazing once you put it all together.
Yeah, the Coctopus people can view online, and we put up a website, cokecash.org. That's the name, K-O-C-H and C-A-S-H, cokecash.org. And you can view that Pretzi online. It's an interactive mapping. It sort of takes you on a tour of their different tentacles of controlling and influencing policy. Their main aim being defending their wealth, which is based on carbon. You know, a lot of people don't know, Charlene, that they are now the world's two wealthiest men. Their combined net worth is more than that of Mexico's Carlos Slim.
Between 2006, it went way up after 2006. Anyway, I need to stop myself here because we have to take an identification break. So we're going to continue this in just a minute, but we'll pause now. This is Charlene Spretnak on All Together Now, speaking with my guest, Victor Minotti. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Victor Minotti, Executive Director of the International Forum on Globalization. And their website is ifg.org, ifg.org. And there are a lot of interesting things on there. There are free reports you can download and all kinds of information about their various projects. We're just talking about a couple of their many projects. So we're speaking specifically about their two latest reports, Faces Behind a Global Crisis, U.S. Carbon Billionaires and the U.N. Climate Deadlock, and also this new one, Billionaires Climate Bomb. So, Victor, I see that, as I say, a lot of the reports are available for free download. Faces Behind a Global Crisis, is this new one not yet posted for people? It's about to be posted or something?
Correct. It's about to be posted. We are at this moment trying to finalize it and get it out because that Billionaire's Carbon Bomb is, of course, about the Keystone XL pipeline. that's
yeah,
the
that
fuse
was extremely
to
interesting too. I was just going to start going to that because I was able to read the executive summary, and that is so timely. Just to, in case there's anyone who's been living in a closet, you know, decision time is coming. The president's going to say something about whether the Keystone XL pipeline is going to go through. And I just want to say that we all may be concerned, but it's the 350.org people who have been showing up. They've shown up with a crowd and signs 30 times since March, every time the president has appeared somewhere or one of his top advisors. And some of the things on those signs and their press releases are now getting into his statements, like, oh, well, this actually is just going to go across this very dirty tar sands oil across our country, endangering our aquifer, only to be exported out of Texas. It's not going to affect the price of oil in our country. And if it, you know, if I'm convinced it's going to contribute a lot of carbon emissions, which it would, you know, then I'll nix it. So all that is very different from the way he was talking a while ago. And I just want to urge people to check the website on 350.org, because they're going to have more coming starting this week about this countdown to the decision making on the Keystone pipeline. But this report that's about to come out from IFG is extremely interesting, because it shows you who stands to benefit and who's really pushing it all behind the scenes. So, Victor, can you tell us about that?
Well, we've been digging it, and we found that the Kochs have 500,000 acres up in Alberta in the tar sands territory, and that they've spent about over $50 million on different front groups and campaign contributions to people who are trying to fast-track the permit for the Keystone XL pipeline, because they stand to make up to $50 billion from just the production alone of the tar sand. So not a bad investment, you know, put in $50 million, get back $50 billion, and then they'll use that to place bigger bets in the oil derivatives markets, which is, as you referred earlier, how they quintupled their wealth in the last 6 years. So, yeah, this is, you know, how the income inequality is going to increase. So what we're saying in this report is that this Koch effect is itself going to have significantly exacerbating impact on carbon pollution, because more money will allow the Kochs to influence more of the decision-making on pollution policy in Washington and the different states where they've been actively, rolling back our regulations.
Yeah. And
that's the headline
think
of the report. It should be out soon.
Uh-huh. And it'll probably be on that other site you just told us about, KochCash.org?
Yes. It'll be on the IFG website and on the Koch Cash website.
Great.
We have all kinds of maps
line
on there.
Sorry?
People can see what we went through and sort of mapped their different investments along the tar sands trail, everything from, you know, the First Nations territory up in the Cree country up in Canada.
Uh-huh.
A lot of resistance to the tar sands exploitation there by native peoples, and the Idle No More movement that has started up there and you know, moving all the way down in the U.S. And of course, you know, ranchers and landowners in Nebraska who are fighting to keep their aquifer risk-free and without having a pipeline run over it, down to, you know, in Texas right now, they're trying to build a portion of what would connect down to the Gulf Coast refineries. And that's, you know, getting lots of direct action from mainly young folks, but landowners also, to try to physically block this pipeline. Because it would set off this carbon bomb. Now, you know, some people say, well, whether you got the pipeline or not, they're going to get that stuff out. Well, that's not necessarily what Wall Street is saying or the investors who are saying, because,
right,
see, they've got so much tar sands there and potential oil, but they can't get it out of out to, like, the markets.
Right.
So they need this pipeline to increase the capacity to take the stuff away. And without it, it doesn't make the tar sands really competitive with other kinds of oil. So that's why they're so desperate to get that pipeline.
Yeah, and I've heard the Canadian bank saying that too, about the Canadian companies involved. If the pipeline is blocked, this is just not a going endeavor as far as we're concerned. which would be fine with the planet. There was a line in I think Faces Behind a Global Crisis, which I couldn't go back and find. It's one of those things, the escaping quote. But it's, I think, derived from partly the work Bill McKibben did on Follow the Numbers, that he was citing this group in London that did an analysis of how much, of the identified holdings of oil corporations can be burned if we want to avoid going beyond a 2% rise in temperature. And of course, as we know, all the Native nations fought to hold that at 1.5% rise, the island nations, but that didn't work at the UN conference, and so everybody said, oh yes, we can hold it at 2%, but that looks doubtful. Anyway, they said, we can only, I think you said 28% in the report, we can only, I think he said 25%, but anyway, around there, that's the amount of the identified reserves we could afford to burn if we're not going to go above a 2% increase in the next few decades.
Two degrees Celsius.
2 degrees increase in the next few decades. But the tar sands themselves would contribute, 30% of that allowable 25 to 28% of the holdings? There was some statement about if the tar sands would contribute horribly, when in fact there are already identified reserves that could provide. It's just a matter of a few people making money on the export.
That's right. A few people, the Coke's $50 billion, you know, we also calculated that. It's about 500,000 times what the average worker on the pipeline will make. So, you know, the benefits of this being distributed are incredibly unequal. And the carbon load of the tar sands itself, as you were saying, I the data I've seen says that it would send the temperature up 2 degrees Celsius just from what the tar sands has. That's different than governments under the UN agreeing to keep everything below a 2 degrees increase in global average temperature. Yeah. So this pipeline is really critical, and it kind of, you know, embodies what's at stake with the paradigm of industrialism and just even this transition to clean energy.
Well, you know, the idea of the UN treaties is depressing, since if it's waiting for us, it'll always be blocked, and this is a bit depressing. And then your very clear chart on what they get when they buy Congress people and senators, and how much donation the Koch brothers get, and what percentage at the time those people receiving those big donations then vote in favor of laws that the fossil fuel industries want. Does it occur to you that campaign finance, I mean, I'm sure it does, but it doesn't seem central with a lot of groups who are just really giving it their all to stop this? I look at that chart and think, you know, the lack of campaign finance reform is going to kill us. It's going to kill the planet, because every single vote is corrupt practically, because the lawmakers are bought off with our current system, and that's going to go on and on. So how do you see that factoring into trying to change things?
Well, campaign finance reform and reducing the role of private money in politics is fundamental to an effective climate movement, and I think some groups are slowly getting this. The Sierra Club's new president, Michael Bruhn, certainly gets this. Uh-huh. That's why you have this new alliance. It's called the Democracy Initiative, with several of the unions and other organizations, NAACP, who are seeing what you are saying. And, you know, I don't want to depress people. That's why let's switch to what's going on here. And that is that movements are coming together, following the money and seeing, hey, it's not a fair fight. No matter what we do in the policymaking arena, we're out rigged by these, you know, billionaires who have rigged the rules and pay off the politicians.
That's right.
So finally, it's the fragmented social movements who are coming together not fast enough, and it needs to happen faster.
Right.
That's part of what I think our work is that you alluded to at the beginning, sort of the relational shift. You know,
yeah.
I think that's very instructive for how social movements need to connect in, you know, just their own connective tissue and awareness about that needs to happen and how it could happen, I think is a very important part of social change. And so that's the process that we see happening and would want to focus on, right? I don't want to be depressing and just bum people out on all this bad data, because there's a lot of great organizing that's going on.
No, I think we couldn't get anywhere without this data, because this gives so much ammunition to the people, you know, who are talking. There are lobbyists on the sane side talking to the lawmakers, too, and to President Obama. So I think it's essential. It's just that when I look at that list of those bought-off lawmakers, I think, oh, my gosh, you know, this is a big issue in the 90s, a lot of hand-wringing. Oh, we've got to have campaign finance reform or we'll never have a good democracy. And both parties saying, oh, yeah, we really want that. And then the Democrats, you know, just faking it over and over again in the 90s and saying, oh, we wish we could have it, but... And then, you know, in the early 2000s, how Maine and Arizona, some grassroots groups said, hey, you know, we can just do this and not wait for the big national parties. And they set up those clean money, clean election laws that really worked in Arizona and Maine. They got, you know, all the state-level officials and a whole bunch of their legislators elected on that program without any private money. And now the big money people have brought all those lawsuits in to get all those successful, democratic, citizen-oriented reforms thrown out. So it's just the other side sees what a big fight it is. They've really, you know, hunkered down on it. But as you say, the social movements need to see this is at the center of all our concerns. We can't get the laws we need, that democracy needs, that the planet needs until we address this. So I think these charts are just really, you know, they make it very simple and dramatic to show, oh, my gosh, it's this extreme. Hello?
Hello.
Oh.
Yeah, no, that was a short. I'm that's what the charts are for, to inform and to inspire action and people to get engaged, you know, two reactions to what you said. You know, one is, why hasn't it changed? Social movements have not made it a core interest to their efforts.
Yeah.
Hopefully that's changing. What has changed also is that now, you know, you mentioned the former bipartisanship on it. Now you really find very few Republicans, even fewer, who are going to do this. In fact, their rhetoric has changed, and Republicans are talking about, you know, getting government out of elections.
Yeah.
You know, it's those clean money options and the publicly financed elections that you talked about, Arizona, Maine, in other words, that are exactly what need to happen. And the rhetoric now from the far right, funded by the Kochs, is that's free elections, or rather publicly funded elections, is the same as subsidizing politicians. They should be relying on private donations. And, you know, so what you've got is sort of the ideological polarization has deepened, and we think that's the intention of the agenda of the Kochs. It's such an ultra form of capitalism that they're advancing here. They would totally transform the role of government, and well, that's what we're seeing social movements coming together.
Yeah, I had not heard that before. So the privatization of the electoral system is on their agenda.
Oh, certainly. You know, if you look at the recent the Supreme Court rulings, just you know, in June, July, the Kochs funded two of those cases. That won. They funded the voting rights rollback. If you look at that group that brought the case, Project on Fair Representation, and you click on Contact Us, it goes to Donors Trust. Donors Trust was set up by the Kochs to move their dark and dirty money anonymously. And you look at one of the other ones, a fellow named Kuntz, who sued a sub-government in Florida over property rights, very important environmental decision. That was funded for a long time by the Koch funded organization. So they're moving in different levels of government, you know, changing the rules. But I think it's you know, that's why we feel that the Keystone fight is really good to show people how all this works, how they make the money from exploiting the planet and you know, not paying people, and then use it to further rig the rules. I mean, the information is there to inform people, but also to inspire them, not just get them mad, but get them to want to take action. And that's, you know, what people can do, I think, by checking the 350 website, like you talked about, 350.org, or also the ifg.org website, as well as this one we set up on the Kochs called kochcash.org.
Great. Thank you so much. We just have about a minute left, but I want you to just tell people a little bit about that extremely interesting program. I advertised it on this show, the Asian Pacific teach-in you had in June, bringing together all these activists from Asian Pacific countries on different issues, the trade pack and climate change. Could you tell us about how that works?
Well, it was a teaching IFG organized in Berkeley to wake up Americans to what President Obama has called the Pacific Pivot. That's the realignment of U.S. Military and commercial and diplomatic power,
right,
from the Atlantic to the Pacific, primarily to encircle China. And it involves both the building of massive new military installations, not just, you know, moving Okinawa to Guam to take over two-thirds of that island, not that they're closing down Okinawa, but, you know, a nuclear submarine station off an island in North Korea, 500 miles from Beijing, you know, things that we're not really told much about in the U.S.
Well,
and,
lots of issues.
You know, we're just told that we're China's
and can people read
aggressive
about that now? I mean, after the fact, the teaching is come and gone. We just really have about a half a minute. But is there a way they can reach about what all those people from other countries came here and said?
Absolutely.
That was so great. You brought
them
together.
We're taking that content from the teaching, and we're putting it up online right now. We should have videos up there within a week. We're
great.
Transcribing the talks, and check ifg.org.
Okay, great. Well, now, folks, you can see why I said at the beginning of the program what a great organization IFG is. And that's all the time we have. But Victor Minotti, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thanks, Charlene.
Let's go over to the Arts Corner now and see what our poem is this week. Well, we have one by Mary Oliver that is about the relationship between humans and the rest of the natural world. In this case, two deer. This poem is entitled 5 a.m. in the Pine Woods. I'd seen their hoofprints in the deep needles and knew they ended the long night under the pines, walking like two mute and beautiful women toward the deeper woods. So I got up in the dark and went there. They came slowly down the hill and looked at me sitting under the blue trees. Shyly, they stepped closer and stared from under their thick lashes and even nibbled some damp tassels of weeds. This is not a poem about a dream, though it could be. This is a poem about the world that is ours, or could be. Finally, one of them, I swear it, would have come to my arms, but the other stamped sharp hoof into the pine needles like the tap of sanity, and they went off together through the trees. When I woke, I was alone. I was thinking, so this is how you swim inward. So this is how you flow outward. So this is how you pray. Our song this week is in honor of all those striking fast food workers in a dozen cities who have gone out on one-day walkouts to demand decent wages while the ownership is making huge profits. So, time for a classic labor song. This is Joe Hill, sung by Joan Baez.
saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, said he. I never died, said he. Copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe. I didn't die, says Joe. I didn't die. And standing there, as life, and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to it's there you find Joe Hill. It's there you find Joe Hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you or me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, said he. I never died, said he.
That was Joe Hill, sung by Joan Baez. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you'd like to see who my guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, charlenespretnak.com, and click on the tab that says Radio. Next week, my co-host, Eleanor LeCain, will be here with her guest, who will probably be David Corton, although that's awaiting final confirmation. I'll be back 2 weeks from today with my guest, Carol Stiller, telling us about successful grassroots activism to greatly reduce gun violence. Thanks for joining us. This is Charlene Spratnak with All Together Now.